on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
A lot of it, again, comes down to belief. What do we believe in, and how far are we willing to go with that belief? And I, again, I respect the right to beliefs of anybody. If you think demons are real, I'm not trying to convince you that they aren't. If you think that they aren't real, I'm not trying to convince you that they are. I'm still undecided. 80,000 words and several years down this road, I did not come to a they are real, they are not real conclusion, you know. But I think they've been with us forever, and they probably will be with us forever, because we need them. They play a role in our society and in our lives.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by Richard Estep, author and paranormal investigator, known for his appearances on shows like Haunted Case Files and Paranormal 911, to discuss his latest book, In Search of Demons. Richard explores the evolution of demonology in popular culture, the real-life cases that inspired The Exorcist, the importance of psychological and medical explanations for alleged possessions, and the influence of belief and cultural narratives on paranormal phenomena. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Richard Estep is an author, paranormal investigator, and TV personality. He has appeared on TV's Haunted Case Files, Paranormal Investigators in the UK, Haunted Hospitals, Paranormal Revenge, Paranormal Night Shift, Paranormal 911, Destination Fear, and A Haunting. He founded the Boulder County Paranormal Research Society in 2006. He's the author of more than a dozen books detailing his most harrowing investigations, including The Great American Ghost Trip and The Horrors of Fox Hollow Farm. He joins me today to discuss his latest book, In Search of Demons. Richard, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you. This is a little bit of a different podcast for me. I don't typically look at paranormal topics, although it's something I'm deeply interested in. But I really wanted to talk to you about your book. I come at this from a background in religious studies, and I found your book really interesting because you spoke to a wide variety of people, including psychologists, fellow paranormal investigators, academics. And I thought that maybe we could begin just a little bit in terms of your interest in this. I know you are also a paranormal researcher, but what led you to write this book?
Well, it's often said that writers will write the kind of books they want to read and can't find. And so I'd wanted to write a book about demons that didn't fall into one of the two camps that seemed to be out there. Because broadly speaking, on the one hand, you had the books that approach the subject with absolute belief and zero skepticism that just said demons are real, we don't question that, but they're terrifying, they're coming to get you. And then the other poll were the kind of uber skeptics who said demons are absolutely not real, these are fairy tales, and you're gullible if you believe this rubbish, which again insults half the people on the planet who do believe in demons. And I thought there's got to be a middle path. There's got to be a way to look at this and say, what is the evidence? What are the possibilities? What are the likelihoods? And I looked for that book. I couldn't find it. So I decided I would go and write it. And here we are.
Yeah. Yeah. And you state very clearly in the book that you don't personally believe in demons, but you also don't not believe in them. So I really appreciated the objective approach that you tried to take. It seems, though, that there's something within the paranormal community and a lot of the entertainment that we see where they are, I don't want to say invoked, I don't mean it in that sense, but people seem to interpret various hauntings as demonic. And one of the reasons for that, I think, is because of the legacy of Ed and Lorraine Warren.
I think that's certainly a part of it. And it was pointed out to me, something I hadn't observed before. But if you look at the quote unquote demonology that's being performed in the US, the vast majority of it seems to take place on the East Coast.
Which
is, of course, the war. Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, you don't see a great deal of it in the Midwest, the Rocky Mountains, the West Coast. A lot of it is the Warren's legacy. And a lot of it is the fact that the East Coast has that puritanical historical, you know, going back hundreds of years.
Right.
So that was pointed out to me, and a really astute observation, I thought. The Warrens, love them or hate them, I know they're very polarizing. They seem to find demons everywhere they went.
Yeah.
And it's something that I struggle with, that being a thing. I also struggle with the fact that it seems today many TV shows have done the same thing, as have many, many YouTubers and other content creators. We've reached a point now where, at least when it comes to content creation, demons are, it's a race to the bottom to find the scariest, the most aggressive. Oh, I escaped with my life from this house of hell. And I just got tired of it, because, you know, with all due respect to those creators, there are some great content creators on YouTube, good, honest, ethical people putting out good information, and I salute those people. Then you have who seem to be the more popular ones, who are just realized demons sell. Dark, demonic, you know, the more demonic, the better it sells. And so what may be an aggressive human haunting, or what may be nothing more than a creaky floorboard in some cases, has been pitched and sold as, you know, an evil demonic case. And these people are pitching themselves as heroes that are literally walking into the mouth of hell and filming it for your entertainment.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of, I don't necessarily want to say scamming, but I know, for example,
I would say
okay.
that
Yeah, okay, perfect.
in some cases, yeah.
Yeah, I know you don't go into detail about this, but it was mentioned in the book, the Dybbuk, which are come out of the Jewish tradition. And I know that there have been a lot of instances of YouTube videos of people with unboxing the Dybbuk boxes that supposedly have this demon in it. And that's been thoroughly debunked, but yet people are still buying into this, and it's really interesting. Why do you think this is so popular? Is it something that is more or less unique to the United States?
So if my book has one weakness that I would love to fix, it is that I am absolutely guilty of doing a westernized Judeo-Christian focused book.
Yeah.
I wish I'd had the budget, quite frankly, to go look at the situation in Africa, Asia, other parts of the world, other cultures. And I would love to do that in future. I
Yeah.
just couldn't do it on, you know, the travel budget that I had was
Right,
pretty
right.
limited. But other, you know, demons have existed throughout human history, and it's a concept that spans many, many cultures.
Right.
However, we have turned them into an industry here in the United States, primarily an entertainment industry, and one that's based on fear. You only need to look at the success of the Conjuring movies and the Conjuring verse to see that people love being scared. And I think a lot of what this is the idea that, you know, you can now pay to go to a location or rent a location and have your own brush with the demonic, and look at how brave you are for doing that. You can puff out your chest, you can come back and tell stories, and you have bragging rights. And it just, I think we've reached a point where people want to be the hero of their own story. They want to be the star. And what better way to be a hero than for you to portray yourself as this, you know, champion in the battle of light versus darkness? And there are individuals doing that are making money on it too. You know, they've set themselves up as quote unquote demonologists. They pronounce themselves experts. I'm not talking about people with years and years of experience in the field. You know, I'm talking about individuals that are relatively new to this, took a course online, maybe bought some vestments and things to the tune of a couple of $100, and have become essentially Christian superheroes in their own portrayals.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And it often seems like there is a little bit of propaganda involved in all of this as well.
A little bit. I think that historically the Christian church has used demons for propaganda for centuries.
Yeah.
The Christian church, and again, I respect the beliefs of pretty much everybody, or at least the rights of you to hold them. I know there's a difference there. I don't have to respect the beliefs, but I have to respect
Right.
your right to hold them. And I'm not going to mock you for holding those beliefs. If you are a Christian, I have great respect for you and your belief system. But when you study the church, it's undeniable historically that the church has sold a narrative to people. You know, going back 1,000 years, the narrative has been, hey, you know, poor farmer, life sucks. You're probably going to be dead by 40. Half your children are dead now, but don't worry, they're in heaven. I can tell you this because I have this special book that only I, the priest, can interpret. Life sucks, but hey, keep working hard. Don't make any trouble. give 10% or more to the church, and we'll square it with the big guy when you get up there. Sound good? And that was kind of the narrative for a long time. Well, how do you motivate people? Every narrative needs a villain, right? Every story needs a villain, which of course is where Satan and Lucifer and demons enter the picture. Satan is the big bad, and the demons are his minions, his foot soldiers in this army of darkness that goes forth and wreaks havoc on the earth. So, you know, your horse went lame, demons. You had a child die, that's awful, demons. You suffered a horrific accident, a demon targeted you. They've made a handy scapegoat for many of the misfortunes that have befallen people over the years. And I think the reason behind that is simple. When it comes down to frightening, and I'm talking now about truly frightening, it is far less frightening to believe that a demon is real and is out there and maybe is targeting you than it is to believe the possibility that we might be all alone in a godless universe, that these bad things randomly happen to good people, because you can't protect yourself against that. And it speaks to that existential dread so many people feel, a void that is filled by religion in believers. You know, it's a terrifying possibility that there are no demons. Bad things happen just because. And they can happen to you, they can happen to me, and there's no defense. If it's a demon, you can go to church, you can pray, you can be devout. There are people within the church, specialists, that will help you cast them out and rid you of them. There's comfort to be had there because it's a kind of manageable fear. And that's easier for us to swallow, easier for us to believe.
Yeah, and if it's not demons, it's witches.
who have been demonized, right?
I mean, right.
You just look at Salem and the many other witch trials and see how the two were put together. You start delving into Salem, it's very apparent that the real monsters in Salem were men who looked a lot like you and I, middle-aged white guys that were making a power grab and that were essentially abusing people because they could, for their own personal gain and for their own personal kicks.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Evil. That's true evil right there.
Yeah, yeah. My family was involved with that. I'm a direct descendant of the early Mathers, including Cotton Mather. Yeah.
So, I mean, what are your thoughts? Because I essentially just vilified your forebears, well, unrepentantly so. But do you agree or do you disagree?
They have a lot to account for. I always see Salem as an example of a lot of petty grievances.
Yeah.
And it was not just necessarily power grabs. I think historically, the witch hunts, especially like in Europe, there's some compelling evidence that it was, like you said, you know, power grabs, but also land grabs. It was, And I also think that in Salem, you know, what sparked it all was a book that Cotton Mather actually wrote.
About, witches, was it?
Yeah. No. He did not write that.
Oh, no. He didn't write that.
Yeah. That was Kramer. And I forget the other person's name. I forget the name of the book he wrote, but it started in Boston, where he had some allegedly possessed girl staying at his house. And that became something like a bestseller in the colonies. And the girls of Salem that first started acting as if they were afflicted by witchcraft really kind of copied what he had written. And it's been suggested that that was one way that they could get attention, because they couldn't as females in Puritan society. And so there was a little bit of power on their part. And then it just became, you know, accusation after accusation after accusation. And I interviewed someone who wrote an amazing book about this, Alice Markham Cantor, I think her name was, The Once and Future Witch Hunt. And she said that what got you killed in Salem was not admitting that you were a witch, but denying it.
Yeah.
So there was a lot going on there.
There was. And in Britain, we had our own witch hunts. You know, we had delightful men like Matthew Hopkins, the Witchfinder General, you know, who shockingly found witches everywhere he went and got paid for it everywhere he went.
Yeah.
So, and it's scary that, you know, we see the term witch hunt crop up in the media to this day, and it seems as if we have learned nothing.
Yeah. We're really bad at learning our lessons, I think. But it also, you know, like you had noted, that there is this historical precedents, not just within Christianity, but even looking at like shamanic cultures, that they're in, you know, there's this idea of the way I learned it was helpful and harmful energies or forces. And it seems like there's, you know, maybe it is part of that existential angst that we feel of trying to understand our way. But the word demon literally comes from the Greek daemon, and the daemon wasn't something that was evil.
Well, I think it was something that could be either, and I talk about this in the book using Alexander the Great as my example. You know, the idea that a daemon could inspire you to do great things. Great is a questionable word because in Alexander's case, it inspired him to go invade yet somewhere else. You know, but by the same token, the flip side of that coin was it was a curse as well. So the idea that it could inspire you to greatness, but then there was a toll to be exacted. And of course, Alexander was in his grave at the age of 32, fragmenting his empire, and the world fell to pieces because of it. And one thing I love is, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but in IT, in a Unix, we have the daemon today. Are you familiar with that? The process that runs in the background that you're not aware of. That's really what a daemon is, right? It's a part of the operating system that lurks beneath the surface and gets things done without the user having to perform actions themselves. So I think that's a beautiful thing.
When I was a graduate student, a course I took, we had to try to create a religious movement of sorts. So we created the cult of the Mailer Demon.
I love it.
But, you know, it's also, you know, I always think not in terms of Alexander, but Socrates. And that kind of what got him killed by listening to his daemon. And, you know, it's interesting to me that in Latin, daemon becomes genius. And there's this sort of creative aspect to it.
This kind of gift from the gods, right? This kind of thing from without that resides within, the spark of divinity may not be the right word, but it's a spiritual power or energy or intelligence that you pay a price for the gift it gives you, which is a story that's as old as folklore, isn't it? You know, if you're going to do great things, then you are going to pay the price for those things.
And, you know, we often think of,
Excuse me.
when we think of demons, we often think in terms of possession. But, you know, and that's something that is also found throughout the world, but it's not always necessarily a negative thing in other cultures. And it's not necessarily a demonic presence.
True. And it's not always involuntary either. You know, I mean, much has been made of voodoo and you know, the voluntary possession that comes with that. And even that has been made scary. You know, thank you, Wes Craven. I think Serpent and the Rainbow is a great movie. Is it Wade Davis?
Yes, Wade Davis,
His book was superb and vastly different to what we saw on screen. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a complex, multifaceted phenomenon, isn't it?
But our understanding of it is, it seems like there's a couple of different trajectories in, at least in American culture, where you have this idea of demonic possession, but then also demons kind of free from a human body that are within a house that are take part of a haunting, if that's the way I can look at it.
And you know, the trouble I have with that logic, Nick, is if you are the boss, if you are the devil, Satan, you want the most bang for your buck, right? You have this war against the light that has been going on for, you know, it's supposedly eternal. So how am I going to do the most damage? I'm going to send minions to foment trouble in the Middle East. I'm going to send demons to Washington to influence the powerful and mighty, and I'm going to send one to a duplex house in Kansas. To wait for, you know, paratourists to come in. It just makes no sense to me whatsoever, that logic.
It doesn't make any sense at all. So, would you say, in your experience, because you've got a lot of experience, would most of the hauntings that are attributed to demonic activity, would that just be a the nasty spirit of a human?
I think we jump very quickly to the conclusion that it is. The idea that there are so many aggressive human beings out there, I work my day job. I'm a 911 paramedic. So this is something that's reinforced every time I go to work. There are so many violent, aggressive, belligerent, toxic humans out there. Why would we assume they'd be any different when they died? I've never believed in the idea that you will instantly graduate to a harp and a halo and angel wings. I think that, if you're going to believe in survival after death, then you are probably going to take the same baggage, issues, personality with you. So if you are manifesting in that way, there are probably going to be scratches and growls and profanity and shoves, right? That does not make for a demon. That makes for a combative, belligerent human being. But I think we far too quickly jump to that D word now, and we have paranormal reality television, we have Hollywood, and we have content creators to thank for it.
And it also, I wanted to talk about sort of the granddaddy of all of this, and that is The Exorcist, because it seems like that was a cultural landmark in many ways in terms of how we think about demons and possessions. And it doesn't seem that before that, there were a few instances, and I do want to talk about some of the cases that influenced that film, but it seems like it, more than anything else, kind of influenced how we think about
Sorry
these
about
things.
that. It did. And one of the things I do talk about in the book was how The Exorcist, before that, the Ouija board was not seen as an object of fear. It was an object of fun. It was on the Love Boat, for goodness sake. It was a fun parlor game. It was a toy. I mean, there were one or two darker cases, but it's only after William Peter Blatty needed some mechanism by which his protagonist, Regan McNeil, could be possessed, and he hit upon the Ouija board. The Exorcist becoming the blockbuster juggernaut that it was and remains today really sealed the fate of the Ouija board, and it brought the devil into movie theaters. And my goodness, that film, Billy Graham, the evangelist, famously said, "The devil is in every frame of that film," which I think is the kind of publicity Warner Brothers could not buy. People were shocked and rushed out to see it in droves. It truly was a blockbuster. People lined up around the block to see that movie, and it was shocking and horrifying, and it has lost none of its ability to shock today, Nick. It's a very powerful film in a way that none of its sequels are. So I think The Exorcist really was a game changer in the public's relationship with demons and the devil, in a way that not even Rosemary's Baby was.
And the film and the book were based allegedly on at least one case. And I think in the book you make the case that there's actually, it borrows from two cases in a sense. But let's talk about those a little bit. Maybe we can start with the first one, with the St. Louis, and I'm not sure how to pronounce the name, the Hunkeler.
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 Yeah, so that's probably the better known of the two. Blatty borrowed liberally from that case, which began in Maryland in 1949. And I encourage any of your listeners that want to learn more about it to read Troy Taylor's book, The Devil Came to St. Louis, which is a terrific analysis of that case, very well researched. You have a 13-year-old boy who begins acting out of character. Phenomena start taking place around him. His bed begins moving without his volition. Furniture moves, objects fly from shelves, those kind of things. His family, the Hunklers, are Lutheran, and the Lutheran faith really does not do demons. And so the Hunklers are famously told, because this is a line that made it into the movie, that you need to go see the Catholics, or in the case of The Exorcist, the Jesuits. They know demons. And so an assessment, an evaluation is performed by two priests who determine that, yes, it's likely that Ronald Hunkler is demonically possessed. Permission is sought for and given for an exorcism to take place. And that begins in the boy's uncle's house in Belknap, the suburb of St. Louis, then continues at the Alexian Brothers Hospital on the university campus. And this is kind of a knockdown, drag out fight, if you will. By day, Ronnie Hunkeler is a relatively normal kid. He begins sleeping through the mornings quite a bit. He plays ball games with his dad. But as the day goes on, he becomes more and more aggressive. He becomes combative. He spits, he claws, he grabs at people. He speaks profanely. He speaks in tongues. He speaks in other voices. He makes animal noises. All the classic tropes of demonic possession that we've seen, he begins to display. And this exorcism continues over the space of several weeks. I think that what gets fascinating to me is we see these wounds appear on Ronnie Hunkeler's body. Some of them are words like hell. Some of them are crosses and symbols, things of that nature. He shows prodigious strength to the point where he has to be held down by grown men and restrained. He does not, contrary to what Hollywood teaches us, levitate. His head does not turn around. He does not vomit pea soup or anything like that. But much of the phenomena that appears in Blatty's novel and movie borrows heavily from that case. So what's fascinating about Ronnie Hunkeler, I think, is that finally his exorcism was successful. He reported seeing Saint Michael, who of course is the archangel that is invoked during any spiritual struggles with the powers of darkness in the Christian realm. Saint Michael appears and drives this great serpent, this demon, back down into the pit and frees Ronnie Hunkeler forever. And as far as we're aware, he remained free. His anonymity was jealously protected. The church absolutely helped do that. They put him in the equivalent of witness protection. They would not give his name out. They would not give his details out. And all credit to them for that. He became a scientist at NASA working on the space shuttle program. In fact, he played a role in developing the ceramic tiles, which the space shuttle uses for Earth re-entry, which I thought was very cool. And he, by all accounts, lived in fear through his entire life, not of being possessed again, but of the fact that people would find out that he was the exorcist boy, which to me speaks to his credibility. Because can you imagine if he had decided to cash in on that? The fortune he would have made, the fame and fortune was there for the taking. And instead, he chose a normal, respectable, ordinary family life, and career and things of that nature. So I find Hunkler a compelling case.
Yeah. Now, do you know if he always believed that he had been possessed, or was there a different, more modern medical explanation?
When he would speak of it, which was rarely, it said that he said it felt as if it happened to someone else, that those were events that were far away in his life. And he did not have recall of them, that he always felt as though this was something that happened to another person, not to him. So, as to whether he genuinely felt he had been possessed by a demon, it's impossible to say.
Okay. Well, and it's, one of the things that you point out in the book is that sometimes the exorcism can have something like a placebo effect,
Yeah,
but it
absolutely.
doesn't seem like that would apply to that case since he was Lutheran. The family was Lutheran, so it wasn't part
Well, they
of.
converted. He converted as part of the process. But I do think that exorcism can have a placebo effect. I also think prayer can have a placebo effect. And the placebo effect is well documented in medicine, and it's no bad thing. I think that belief is immensely powerful.
Right.
Immensely powerful, as we've seen. Belief can motivate people to do the most wonderful and the most horrific things. So I see prayer as kind of directed belief, directed intent. And for Ronnie Hunkeler to have a room full of people and essentially a whole team full of people praying over him for weeks, maybe that did have a positive effect. One thing that I definitely would emphasize is that each year, exorcisms kill far more people than possessions do. I did not get to delve too much into the horrific case of Annelise Michel, which deserves, has gotten books of its own anyway. But you have situations in which individuals die under exorcism because of malnutrition, because of hormonal imbalances and things of that nature. This happens annually. So exorcism can be dangerous, but when performed, I think, appropriately under clinical supervision, it can be very beneficial. Whether you believe it's actually driving out a demon, or whether the ergumen, the person who is the subject of the exorcism, believes it, is the key question, right? But I think belief is at the heart of that.
Yeah. And one of the things that I noticed in the book, and I understand you had to sort of limit the topics you were looking at, but we typically associate exorcism with the Catholic Church. But there is, I know, in some of the more fundamentalist strands of Christianity, like in the Pentecostal tradition, happens quite a bit.
Yeah, and it's also, I think there's also a misperception that it's a one and done thing.
Right.
Whereas people, much like you might need a booster inoculation, people can be re-exorcised repeatedly throughout their life when symptoms begin to recur.
Yeah. Well, and that is what happened, I believe, in the other case that was borrowed from for The Exorcist, and that was the one with Emma Schmidt.
Yeah, the Erling, Iowa case, which predated the Hunkler case by 20 years. And my understanding is that that's a movie that I think will be released in 2025, starring Al Pacino. And it's fascinating because when you read the source material from that, the stuff that appears in Blatty's novel and Friedkin's movie very much appears lifted from the Erling case. In this case, you do have a female who was exorcised as a young woman and then is re-exorcised in the 1920s when she is middle-aged because she is repossessed, for want of a better term. That's every bit as fascinating. This happened in a convent in small town Iowa. Again, we see the immense strength, we see the speaking in tongues, we see the profanity, we see the animal noises. She would bark like a dog, meow like a cat, moo like a cat, quack like a duck, all this kind of stuff, and would speak in multiple different voices, one of which claimed to be Judas Iscariot,
Right.
stated that, the intent of the possession, the goal, was to drive her to commit suicide, to take her own life. The belief at the time being very much that suicides went instantly to hell and that would be a victory for the devil, essentially, if she was driven to kill herself.
Yeah, and that's fascinating, but it also wonders, kind of the point that you made earlier, why would the devil, if, look at politicians and strife in the Middle East, why go after a young girl in Iowa?
I mean, there's this idea though that the more devout you are, the more of a target you are. It's not a tongue-in-cheek statement, but one thing that really stood out for me when I talked to some of the experts for this book was one of them said, the best defense against possession is to be an atheist,
Right.
because atheists don't seem to be targeted, almost as if they have no value to the devil, but the devil seems to value taking Christian souls away from his adversary. But I always asked, why would God allow someone to be possessed? And there was a very interesting answer in the Erling case, and it was that she was supposedly possessed by this host of evil spirits, not all of whom were demonic. Beelzebub, Lord of the Flies, was one of them, but then there were a host of dead human souls as well, negative human souls. So the idea that you can be possessed by a non-demonic deceased human spirit, it is an important one. But the stated reason was that while these souls, these entities, these dark entities were all imprisoned within her, they were not out there in the world wreaking havoc. It's almost as if she was allowed to be a penitentiary for evil spirits during the course of her possession, which I found to be a very interesting perspective.
Yeah, it is. Of all these cases, is there one that you think, and maybe it's you've already answered this, but is there one that you think is the most convincing?
I do find the Hunkeler case convincing, or at least I think it defies an easy explanation. What I keep coming back to, though, is we're in the 21st century now, right, Nick? We have 4K cameras everywhere. You have one in your pocket, probably. I certainly have one sitting right here. So when we hear about cases like the Ammons case, which, Zach Bagans purchased the house and made much hay with that, you hear stories of people walking up walls and contravention of the laws of gravity and things like that. Where is that one compelling piece of footage?
Right.
When Americans and indeed humans are on camera more than at any other point in history, we all have these recording devices in our pockets. Where is that one compelling piece of footage that says, this is real, this is happening? I've yet to see it.
Right. Right. Yeah, good point. So I think that most, from a skeptical perspective, I think a lot of people are going to suggest that there's something psychological that's happening, perhaps, or there could be even something physical. And I thought that it was really interesting because one of the things that you went into in the book was the dissociative identity disorder, which used to be referred to as multiple personalities. And I just have to point out, one of the things that you noted was that that seems to be something that happens primarily in the United States. Yeah, I thought that was fascinating.
I talked to a clinical therapist about that. So DID, or multiple personality disorder, it used to be called, usually arises from trauma at a fairly young age. It is a trauma response. And in the case that I looked at, one of the dominant personalities literally called itself Demon. It identified itself as Demon, but Demon was working to protect its host. So the idea that you might actually have a demon doing a good thing, of course, it's not literally a demon. We're not talking about a hellspawn here. But the idea that, we could see a form of mental illness which is shaped towards something that the lady was obviously very familiar with, the idea of a demon, just fascinated me, And there is a psychological component to many of these cases. Again, belief. The odds are great that if you don't believe, you won't be possessed. Why is that? Well, some Christians would say it's because you're not worth the devil's time. If you're not a Christian, he's not taking you away from God. Others would say that, you are open, you are more open to possession if you are undergoing a state of mental illness, if you are depressed, if you are dealing with mental issues, then that makes you more vulnerable. And I think the mental health link is an absolutely essential one. The Catholic Church does require an evaluation by a clinical professional prior to authorizing an exorcism anymore. As well, they should. That being said, I do wonder how many individuals are given exorcisms who instead should be given medication and therapy. But the flip side, because I do try and see both sides, Nick, Christians like to point out that how many individuals are written off as having mental illness and inappropriately diagnosed when the real problem is possession. That sword cuts both ways, doesn't it?
And well, and I think that, I'm not entirely not an expert on this, but I know that the Catholic Church has very specific procedures for this. I don't know if the same can be said for some of the Protestant ecstatic kind of religious traditions that also recognize possession.
Yeah, I don't either. But I do know that if you do not consider the possibility of a mental health issue, it's unethical. You cannot simply go in there and subject somebody to an exorcism without covering all alternative explanations first.
Yeah, and you note this, it's very clear that the prerequisite is to come to terms with their trauma first.
Absolutely.
And I found it fascinating in the case that you were talking about with the young woman that had the dissociative identity disorder, that personality called Demon went from being a tormentor to an ally.
To aiding the therapist, that they were both on the same page with the goal of helping the tormented young woman. I thought that was fantastic.
And that made me think of Carl Jung a little bit and the idea of embracing our shadow. And that is another option here, is that the demonic is archetypal. And
Absolutely.
perhaps the archetypes are, they're odd things that manifest and have an energy all of their own, sometimes it seems.
Absolutely. And I talked a lot about archetypes with Bishop Brian Ouellette of the All Catholic Church. I thought that if anyone was going to give me the fire and brimstone approach, it was going to be Brian, but he was extremely thought-provoking with what he said and his perspective. And he did talk about the nature of archetypes and their place in human history and in our composition. So we've always needed demons, I think, to the point where, there's that old saying that if the devil isn't real, it will be necessary to invent him. And I think the same is true with demons as well. They serve a purpose and always have.
And the other thing that you noted, I just wanted to bring this up in the sense of, since we're looking at alternative explanations, is a, I'm trying to find it here in my notes. It was anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis.
Yeah, which I have to thank Dr. Kieran O'Keefe, the parapsychologist, for that, because that was something that I don't delve too deeply into it because he has a research paper coming out about that. But when I interviewed him, you know, it was kind of a case of watch this space. But when I interviewed him, he wanted to make it clear that, hey, this is a potential alternative explanation in certain cases.
Yeah.
So one of the reasons I wanted to interview medical doctors in addition to psychological clinicians was to look at some of those brain conditions, those brain etiologies. One thing that fascinated me was, and this is a dreadful subject, I'm afraid, Nick, but dementia. Dementia sufferer, it's the cruelest disease imaginable, isn't it?
Yeah.
But there is a phenomenon called sundowning where some dementia patients are relatively normal, relatively themselves in the daylight hours. But as the night draws in, things get dark outside, they regress and they become almost more animalistic, impossible to calm down. They shriek, they cry, they're severely distressed, they yell, they attack sometimes. It's called sundowning. And I noticed that in the cases of both Erling, Iowa, and the Hunkler case in St. Louis, both of the subjects of those cases, the arguments, showed the same behavioral pattern. They were relatively okay when the sun was high in the sky, but then when, you know, evening arrived, their behavior deteriorated very quickly. And you have an organic brain condition going on with dementia. So, you know, CT scans, imaging of the brains of allegedly possessed people is definitely something worth pursuing. And I think Friedkin does a great job in the movie The Exorcist. One of the more frightening sequences in that movie is where Reagan, where they're looking for a brain lesion with Reagan, right? And they put her into the scanner. You have this very loud, clanking, terrifying experience. For that section of the movie, we're actually looking at medical horror.
Yeah.
We're looking at, you know, how frightening is it to put this young girl, cold and scared and alone, into this clanking medical device that looks inside her brain.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and it made me wonder, you know, The Exorcist is what, 50 years old now?
Yeah, and if that doesn't make you feel old, what will?
Yeah, I know. Well, yeah, when Star Wars hits 50, that one'll hurt.
Oh, it's a coming.
Yeah, I know. But I mentioned that because it makes me curious if there has been any other, and I doubt there has been, any like brain scans of allegedly possessed people with more modern equipment.
If so, I've not been able to find any, and I'm sure there have been, but those will be part of their confidential medical records. I've not seen
Right.
any medical studies
Right.
that look at that and draw conclusions.
Okay.
And
yeah.
I think it's because studying quote unquote possession, excuse me, is probably does not reflect well on one's chances of doing well in academia, you know?
Yes. Well, and that's something in terms of the paranormal in general that academics tend to shy away from, it with a few exceptions. For example, Jeff Kripal at Rice University
mm-hmm.
kind of looks at these things. And
yeah.
you spoke to someone, don't know if I have it in my notes. I know I've got them somewhere, but you did speak to a religious studies professor, I believe.
Yeah, that was Professor Joe Laycock working out of Texas. Joe
Yes.
is the acknowledged expert on the Erling, Iowa exorcism. And again, very graciously lent his expertise and perspective to this book. And, you know, Joe has a very balanced view of the situation. He offers some alternative explanations, but ultimately, I think the jury is still out on that case.
Okay. The one that I had not heard of, and I thought that this was really interesting, and I wanted to ask about, was a sort of a more modern version, I suppose, which is Zozo, who you
yeah.
noted as the foremost demon of the internet age.
I think the only one I'm aware of. So Zozo is an interesting phenomenon because Darren, and I really must apologize to Darren because his last name just flew right out of my head, Evans. Darren Evans experienced this creature on a Ouija board. The idea that the planchette would zip between the Z and the O, back and forth, Zozo. Now, this really took off when he did an episode of the TV show Ghost Adventures. But even before then, he published some of his findings on the internet. And had heard from individuals that said they'd had a similar experience, and almost all of them had bad things happen in their lives after their Zozo encounter. But the idea that word of Zozo seemed to spread memetically across the internet was a fascinating one. And Darren is convinced that he has evidence of Zozo going back in historical documents hundreds of years, which, that's certainly what he believes strongly. But it's not something that many people seem to have encountered until the 21st century. So I find the idea fascinating that Zozo became a pop culture phenomenon and more people began reporting experiences with this entity on the Ouija board after that episode of Ghost Adventures aired.
Yeah, that's interesting. And it leads to, I'm going to try to express this as best as I can, this idea that I'm going to take this. I'm a huge fan of Greg and Dana Newkirk. And one of the things that Greg Newkirk says is that it's people are haunted, not houses. And they have this idea that other objects can be haunted. And the more attention that people put onto these things, the more effects that you get, in a sense. And it seems like that's something that's happening with Zozo and also perhaps with some of these places like the Demon House, for example, that you had previously mentioned, that it's more of a collective creation in a sense.
I mean, it's that old saying that your focus determines your reality, right? I think the more energy you put into something, or the more energy people collectively put into something, the more likelihood you have of bringing it to life. I'm a big fan of the author Terry Pratchett. If you've ever read any of his fiction, he has a book called Small Gods, and the concept of that is terrific. The idea that through our history, gods have literally existed, but only for as long as they are believed in. And as belief starts to wax and wane a little bit, as belief dies off, they lose power, they lose prominence, therefore fewer people believe in them. They kind of enter this spiral of belief until, they become a footnote in the annals of history. And so I like the idea, and I find it very credible that mass belief is a powerful, powerful force, and may well be able to manifest in ways which seem like fiction to us.
Yeah. And it seems like, if that's the case, then the way to kind of counter a lot of these things is to sort of figuratively or maybe even literally turn our backs again to them.
Atheists don't get possessed.
And, but and I'm always curious too, is, you have this idea that especially the one that the demon becomes an ally. You know, maybe there's something that maybe there's a message for humanity here with all of this idea. Maybe there's something, since it seems to be very dominant in American culture, maybe there's a message for us that we need to take away from all of this.
The one that I've internalized, and I feel very good about having done this, because number one, it's good to do good things, but number two, there's a certain symmetry to it. But as this book came out, Llewellyn gave me a number of advanced copies to send to reviewers. They sent out copies. I auctioned several of them off for animal rescue charities, and I used the hashtag demons doing good. So the idea that I was forcing demons to do good things, I think would really have annoyed them. And I really like that. So it's a funny dichotomy to me, but a lot of it again comes down to belief. What do we believe in, and how far are we willing to go with that belief? And I respect the right to beliefs of anybody. If you think demons are real, I'm not trying to convince you that they aren't. If you think that they aren't real, I'm not trying to convince you that they are. I'm still undecided. 80,000 words and several years down this road, I did not come to a they are real, they are not re real conclusion, But I think they've been with us forever, and they probably will be with us forever because we need them. They play a role in our society and in our lives.
Well, and that's I think probably a good place to start wrapping this up. So let me ask you, what are you working on next?
Well, I am currently working on a book for September of next year, 2025. The book is about the Mothman phenomenon viewed through the same lens. So I just got back from Point Pleasant, West Virginia, the Mothman Festival, where you have 20,000 people close to enough to all of them thinking about Mothman. So that has been a delight to research, and I'm wrapping the writing stages of that up now with my co-author. I have a book coming out in February called Dark Spirits, which looks at the darker side of the paranormal, although perhaps not in the way that everybody thinks. So that's been fun to do. And I'm working on a book that reviews some of the great hauntings of our time and casts a fresh eye on those.
Okay. Can I ask how the Dark Spirits book is going to be different from the Demon book?
Yeah, the idea that darkness is part of our world and is part of the paranormal. Darkness sells, but I've also found that when you dig into a lot of paranormal cases, the darkness that you find isn't necessarily paranormal or supernatural, or call it what you will. There is some very real darkness that wears a human mask and a human face. So while I am talking about phenomena, I also am trying to look at things a little bit differently. And I'll give you an example of one that's fairly innocuous. I looked at the Bermuda Triangle. And what fascinates me about the Bermuda Triangle is I was a kid of the 70s, so I grew up with In Search Of and all that kind of stuff. I loved it. That I can hear that theme music now in my head. And the Bermuda Triangle was a huge thing, right? We have Charles Berlitz really to thank for that. Well, if you look at Lloyd's of London, who are the biggest maritime insurer in the world right now, it is no more expensive to insure a vessel traveling through the Bermuda Triangle than a vessel that is not traveling through the Bermuda Triangle. Statistically, that body of ocean is no more dangerous than any other. So, I love the idea that I can look at some of these sacred cows and see if there is any truth behind them or if maybe they have not aged well.
Yeah, we don't really hear too much about the Bermuda Triangle anymore.
No, it used to be a massive thing. It used to be huge, and it's kind of cool. I looked at the Philadelphia experiment, the USS Eldridge. This one, again, thank you, Charles Berlitz. This fantastical story of a ship that was sent, through time, paranormally was sent through time. It looks as though what was actually happening and what people really saw was degaussing of the ship's hull, which is a procedure used to make it less attractive to mines. Demagnetization in order to make it, more slippery when it comes down to mines. But there has been a whole cult growing up around that, a whole culture.
Right.
So there are definitely some genuinely dark cases and hauntings that I wanted to write about in this book as well. It's not a bait and switch, but it was more a way for me to look at, some of the sacred cows in our field from a different angle.
Yeah. Well, I'll look forward to reading that, and I have a personal love for the Mothman, so I'm looking forward to that. Can you give any hints about that, your approach with the Mothman?
Yeah, I mean, the winged humanoid phenomenon is a fascinating one. So I was just in Van Meter, Iowa, researching the Van Meter Visitor. I don't know if you're familiar with that case.
No, I'm not.
Oh, that's a great rabbit hole to go down. We looked at the Chicago man sightings as well and things of that nature. But having gone to Point Pleasant and talked to people who were there at the time, it fascinates me that nobody was using the term Mothman initially. They all described it as this large black bird about the size of a Cessna. So they called it the Black Bird. It was only when a reporter, a local journalist, wanted to put a spin on it. And, during the late 60s, what was the most popular show on American TV? Batman. Adam West and Burt Ward. So there was literally a headline that was like, "Move over, Batman. Here comes Mothman." And a phenomenon was born right there. So, the opportunity to look into that was kind of fascinating to go to Point Pleasant and see what people thought, to get out to the TNT area, to go to the places where these sightings happened and get a fresh perspective on that was wonderful. I will say that I think it's the connection that's been made between the bridge collapse, the Silver Bridge disaster, and Mothman. I find that very, very, very tenuous.
Okay, yeah,
You know?
because you hear often that Mothman appears right before some great tragedy.
Yeah, harbinger of disaster. But again, having talked to primary sources, the people who were there at the time, nobody equated the quote unquote Black Bird or the Mothman with the Silver Bridge collapse until John Keel needed an ending for his book.
Yeah, so it gets put out there and then becomes part of the belief system of so many people.
Yeah, and remain so to this day. There's a fascinating phenomenon there. And again, it's not that I'm attempting to debunk. I think the story is interesting enough without garnishing it.
Right. Well, yeah. And I, you know, this is my personal interest with the paranormal is I think there's something going on that needs explained and that helps us understand our reality. I never think that we should ignore it. I think it's a very interesting place to examine and see what's going on.
Absolutely, me too. And I just, you know, the whole demons thing, bringing it back to that. I just think the portrayal of the demonic for views, for clicks, for likes, for money has gotten so skewed it's almost meaningless now. And I wanted to take a more sober, level-headed look at that phenomenon, and that's what I hope to achieve with this book.
Well, it was a really fun read. I enjoyed it quite a bit, and it seems like there's a lot of places to go from there as well. So I thank you for that. Do you have a website where people can go to find out more about you and your work?
Absolutely. You can find me over at richardsstep.net.
Okay. And the In Search of Demons, that came out in September, correct?
Yep, September 8th.
Okay, perfect. So, well, Richard, thank you so much for your time today. I really enjoyed speaking with you. And I encourage people who have an interest to read your book. It is very objective. You do talk to a lot of different people. And it's a fun read.
Thank you very much. I appreciate hearing that.
And that's a wrap on episode 154 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're part of my YouTube audience. Now, my longtime listeners know what's coming up next. All the usual. Sign up for my Patreon. Share this with friends, family, and on social media too, please. And subscribe or follow the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. You know the drill. But the thing is, all of that is really important. Right now, putting together this podcast is a labor of love, and I do love it. I'm in the process of making changes to improve the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's slow going, but your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I provide now. As I always like to say, I'm here in the front range doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, psychedelics and consciousness, the esoteric, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's relationship with the sacred earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and you know I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to, or watching, Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be at peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.